It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Hammersmith Grove in Hammersmith, W6. One street west of the pickup by George Edward Heath. One street north of the Blind Obsession murders. And just three streets south of the cruel and sadistic killing spree by the shoebox killer. Coming very soon to Murder Mile. To the side of Hammersmith Broadway Station, on the Hammersmith and City Line, stands a defunct set of railway arches for the disused Grove Road Station. It's the kind of place you might go for a baggie of skag, a swift hand shandy, a dodgy geezer doing barely legal MOTs for a tenner, a handgun for a pony, and a safe blown for a score. But mostly, it's full of rats, mice, litter, porn mags, and pigeon poop. Back in the 1940s, 16 Railway Arches was the pay office for George Wimpey & Co. With a little window where labourers came to collect their weekly wage from Alfred Mitchell, the pay clerk. Being a discreet wooden office in a yard full of lorries, steamrollers and building materials, with no signs as to this arch's purpose, you would only go there if you knew where it was, what it was and why it was there. So it's odd that on the 9th of November 1940, at just before 4 a.m, the pay office was broken into and three men were attacked in their beds as they slept. But was this a robbery, a cover-up, or was it revenge? My name is Michael, I'm your tour guide, and this is Murder Mile. Episode 252. The Sleepers. By November 1940, 2 months into a perpetual 8-month bombing campaign by the Luftwaffe, an enforced blackout had left the city in total darkness, and with millions of civilians evacuated to the country, a fleet of labourers remained to repair the infrastructure and to keep the city running. That night, Hammersmith Grove was patrolled by George Chinnery, an air raid warden who ensured that not a lamp, a bulb, a fire or a match gave away a single position in the city to the looming bombers above. On Saturday the 9th of November, at precisely 4 a.m.
I know it was that time, as the clock had struck four.
George stated,
I saw a bright light shining from one of the arches.
As a local lad, he knew the yard was always open. He knew it was regularly patrolled by William Sturgeon, the night watchman. He knew that 16 Railway Arches was the pay office for George Wimpey & Co. And he knew that Alfred Mitchell, known as Fred, had recently begun sleeping there with the boss's permission, as had two of the gangmasters, William Dyer and Harry Jameson,
owing to the long shifts they'd been working. Entering the yard, he saw nothing suspicious. Just a shaft of light from a bare bulb in the rear office, shining through a wide-open window in the front office, whose blackout cloth had been removed. And with it being against blackout regulations, it was his job to enforce it. Sticking his head in through the window, I saw a man asleep on a camp bed. Dressed in pajamas, with his head on the pillow and his blankets up to his chest, George shouted to the sleeper, "Is anyone awake?" And although the sleeper didn't stir, from the rear office, the silhouette of Harry Jameson did. "Here, put that light out," George barked, the large W on his helmet making it clear who he was and why he was there. But as Jameson slowly stumbled into the light, it was clear that something was wrong. The air raid warden was let in via the door, which wasn't locked. But then again, it was never locked. Inside the rear office, barely 14 feet long by 9 feet wide, the windows were closed. The blackout cloth was still in place. Nothing had been ransacked. And on one of the camp beds sat Wilfred Dyer. In shock, he nursed a 3-inch wound from his left eye to his ear as a suspected skull fracture bled. Jameson, also wearing pajamas, had a 2-inch wound to his forehead, 2 puncture wounds to his forearm and right shoulder, a suspected skull fracture. And although the office itself was intact, with nothing obviously missing, the walls were spattered with blood as both men had stumbled deliriously. Struggling to recall what had happened, as both men drifted in and out of consciousness, Dyer stated, "A man broke in and attacked us while we slept," which was consistent with their injuries. But having occurred during a blackout and having sustained head wounds, all Harry Jameson could recall was, "I caught the shadow of a man in the doorway of the front office. I was on my knees at the time, so I can't judge his height. He was wearing a hat of some sort. It wasn't a cap, but a felt-type trilby." And as descriptions go, that was all he could remember. The air raid warden called the police and administered first aid to the 2 injured men. But it was as he went into the front office to check on the silent and seemingly sleeping frame of Alfred Mitchell that he realised he was dead. Mitchell's autopsy was conducted by Sir Bernard Spilsbury, who stated, "A violent single blow from behind, whilst in a sitting position, caused a wound 2 inches in length on the right-hand side of the top of his head. The skull was not completely exposed, and the cause of death was hemorrhage on the lower region of the brain." The investigation was headed up by Divisional Detective Inspector Frederick Young, who was left with a perplexing mystery. As with no signs of any struggle or robbery, even though the temperature of the body confirmed that they'd been attacked within the last hour, with no other witnesses, Jameson only had brief flashes of memory, and whereas Dyer could remember almost nothing. The theory that this was a burglary proved problematic, as whoever had broken in had used a crowbar to jimmy the front office window. Only with it not being locked and only held shut with a hasp, it didn't need a crowbar to open it, which anyone who had been there before would have known. Below the window, on a desk,
police found a palm print and a boot mark which matched none of those who were injured or murdered. But proof that the assailant had entered and exited via this route, which, just like the crowbar, made no sense, as everyone knew that the main door was never locked. Recreating the event, the police hypothesized that as the suspect got in, his entry awakened Mitchell from his drunken sleep, and he was bludgeoned over the head with a fire poker or crowbar, which was never found, suggesting the killer had taken it with them. Mitchell's body was mistaken by the warden as sleeping, as there were no signs of any struggle. And having entered the rear office, the assailant attacked Dyer, then Jameson, and then made his escape. But what was the motive? Outside of the open window, a wooden tray containing documents was found, but none were of any financial value. In the rear office, nothing was taken, and although the front office had a desk, a deed box, and an iron safe containing £150, 2 shillings and 8 pence, roughly £8,000 today, nothing was stolen. It may seem odd that the security was so lax, but even though the weekly wage stored in the safe for upwards of 120 men was sometimes as much as £1,000, £53,000 today, they'd never had a robbery, as few people knew that the money was there, and no one was stupid enough to try and steal it. There were no signs of disorder, no drawers were opened, and still in Mitchell's pocket was his wallet, as well as his savings book, his letters, and the keys to the safe. So if the culprit hadn't been disturbed, or a robbery wasn't the motive, was this a case of mistaken identity, or was the attack personal? Several bottles of beer were found in the office, confirming what Dyer and Jameson had stated, that all three men had to drink together before they went to bed at 11:15 p.m. On the bottles, the fingerprints of Dyer, Jameson and Mitchell were found, as well as one other person. But who was he? As part of the investigation, every street, bush and drain was searched in a vain attempt to find the murder weapon. All employees who were paid weekly by the dead man were interrogated. Their clothes were checked for bloodstains, in an era when most workmen had just two sets of clothes. And although hundreds of current and former employees were questioned, not a single suspect was identified. So why had these three men been attacked? The dead man was 41-year-old Alfred Mitchell, known as Fred. Born and raised in Peterhead, a poor town in the Scottish county of Aberdeenshire, he left school aged 14, and being short and stocky, he was destined to become a labourer. But also, being good at maths, he progressed to being a pay clerk. Recently separated from his wife, at the start of the war, Mitchell had moved into his sister's home at 77 Verulam Road in St Albans. But finding the daily commute to Hammersmith too long, his bosses let him sleep in the office, providing extra security for the wages. Mitchell was reliable and strict, with no criminal record. But he wasn't what you'd call popular. Described by Dyer as bad-tempered, all agreed he was a heavy drinker with an officious manner with the labourers, many of whom were Irish. Like many of the ill-informed who get their facts from a tabloid, Mitchell despised the Irish, and with all the irony lost on him,
he accused these foreigners of not being good workers. He blamed them for being both work-shy and stealing locals' jobs, even though he himself had travelled from Scotland to take a Londoner's job. He was a bigot, but as many who knew him would agree, he was all mouth and no trousers. The two injured men were Wilfred John Dyer and Harry Jameson. Born in Hook Norton in Banbury in 1902, Dyer had spent his working life from the age of 13 in manual labour, as a farmhand, a carter, a timber merchant and a builder, until 1933 when he joined Wimpy's, and he'd been there ever since. As a liked and respected gangmaster, when the windows of his home were blown in by a bomb, he was permitted to sleep in the office. His roommate in the back office was fellow gangmaster Harry Jameson. Born in the Scottish town of Lawrence Kirk in 1908, Jameson, a son of a gangmaster, had worked from the age of 14 as a baker, an attendant at the Fife and Kinross Mental Hospital, and the night shift at the Dundee Mental Ward, until 1937, when he became foreman at Wimpy's, and he slept on site as the wartime road repairs had kept him busy. None of these three men who were attacked had criminal records. They had no debts, they had known each other for at least 3 years, and they were all described as powerfully built and more than able to defend themselves from an attack. Of the former employees of Wimpy's who were questioned, Dyer couldn't remember a single incident or person who would have a reason to attack him. Jameson had a minor falling out with a labourer who had stolen a pick and a shovel. And although there were two recent events where Alfred Mitchell had been accused of shortchanging a labourer, police said, "It was suspected that one of these men may have killed Alfred Mitchell out of spite." Only Alfred didn't decide the rates of pay. That was his boss's. And just because he was the only one who died of his injuries, that didn't mean that he was the intended target. But he could have been. Friday the 8th of November 1940 was an ordinary night for the three men. With the skies bruised by dark clouds and the unlit streets like a flat sheet of black ice, the chance of a blitz bombing that night was slim but not unexpected. Having spent the day shuttling labourers across the West End to fill in bomb craters in the roads, at 6 p.m. they finished for the day as per usual. Catching up with Gangmaster John Mitchell, whose finger, palm and boot prints didn't match any of those found at the crime scene, as Dyer and Jameson went to the chippy, Nicol and Mitchell headed to the Maltzman and Shovel pub at 6 King Street in Hammersmith, where the two others would join them later. As pub regulars, the landlord described them as some of my most well-behaved customers. Being good friends, I've never heard them have a disagreement in the year they've been coming here, and they come in every night. And drinking 2 to 3 pints of stout and a double whiskey chaser, they were merry but not drunk when they left at 10 p.m, closing time, having bought 3 bottles of brown ale. It was a carbon copy of almost every night which had preceded it. Only a hint of political disquiet would creep in. At 10:15 p.m, at the entrance to the railway arches, Jameson met 2 Irish labourers who he knew well, being part of his civil defence crew. They were John Crowley, aged 23, and Joseph Malloy, aged 25. And having been to the nearby George pub, the chat was friendly.
"Hey, Jock, how you doing?" "Oh, not so bad. Yourself?"
As they spoke about work,
life, family, and the war. John recalled, I didn't know Dyer, but I knew Fred Mitchell, who was the pay clerk at Wimpy's, as he paid me my money each week. Everything seemed fine, until Mitchell's anti-Irish bigotry rose to the surface. The Second World War would prove a decisive moment for Ireland, as with the Irish head of state, Éamon de Valera, fighting for independence from Britain. Although some advocated for Ireland to fight in the war on the Allied side, others like Éamon sought neutrality, stating, England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity. Britain needed Ireland, but unwilling to give up sovereignty, Ireland had Britain over a barrel. As a Scotsman, Mitchell had no experience of Irish politics, except for the toilet bowl of half-truths he had read in his tabloid rag, believing he was reading the truth rather than a piece of propaganda by the publishers for financial and political gain. But that didn't stop him from expressing his ill-informed opinion. Everyone from both groups agreed. Mitchell started arguing. Molloy said, he shouted, to blazes with the Irish, and said we were no good, and why didn't we go back home to our own country? Entirely missing the irony. Crowley said, he started talking about the Irish bases. We didn't have a row, and I ignored what he said about us. I told Mitchell I was just as proud of being an Irishman as he was of being a Scotchman. And with no pushing and no shoving, it was a one-sided dispute by a bigoted turd with a big gob. Dyer said, the argument was a friendly one. Molloy said, I didn't get upset. I could see he was a bit unhappy. But he wasn't much drunk, so we bid them all a good night. And Jameson would state, I could see a fight was brewing, so I told them to clear off. With the tension diffused, Crowley and Molloy went back to their lodgings at 170 Hammersmith Grove, as seen by their landlady, the lodgers, and they didn't emerge until 7:30 a.m. And doing the same, Nicholl said goodbye as Jameson, Dyer and Mitchell headed back to their camp beds at 16 Railway Arches. Back at the office, they changed into pyjamas. They finished their bottles of beer. They had a friendly chat, with no one upset about the previous political spat. And at 11:15 p.m, they went to bed. Nobody left during the next 5 hours, until someone attacked them in their sleep. But if it wasn't Crowley and Molloy, who was it? From what little Jameson could remember, he'd state,
I was asleep. I heard someone moving. I got up and received a blow on the head.
As the dark shadow in the felt Trilby hat whacked him over the head with possibly a crowbar. Falling to his knees,
I got up and pushed a man against the partition. The next thing I know, he struck me with several blows. Then I shouted for Dyer to look out.
Or did he? One theory that the police investigated was that this could have been an inside job, that Jameson and Dyer had attacked themselves to create an alibi. But with nothing stolen, no issue with Mitchell, and no way or time to dispose of the weapon, the injuries were deemed too severe to be self-inflicted. Of the shadowy assailant, Jameson said,
I couldn't see who he was.
But what he did say was,
His shadow was similar in build to the Night Watchman.
"63-year-old William Sturgeon was the night watchman at the Railway Arches. Said to be small and frail, he wasn't there as security, but to check on the offices and to keep the boiler fires burning during the night. Friday the 8th of November was a regular shift for William, starting at 5:30 p.m. when most of the labourers were going off duty. In his office at the back of 16 Railway Arches, he put his food away and then locked up the garage at the far end of the yard. After that, he went to Wimpy's main office at 27 Hammersmith Grove to secure it, put the lights out, lock the doors, fuel the boiler.
And I returned at 7:15 to collect my helmet and coat. I heard the voices of Mitchell, Jameson and Dyer in the adjoining office. I didn't see them, but I told them to lock up properly to prevent any light leakage. I only mentioned this as they have a habit of leaving the office open and the lights on.
This was what the night watchman told the police, adding,
"At about midnight, I checked their office. I couldn't tell if they were in or not, as the lights were off and the passage door was shut but not locked."
And as was his duty,
"At 2 a.m, I did another round of boiler fires. Everything was all right. And I didn't see anyone else in the yard at all that night."
But how truthful was his statement? He claimed,
"I didn't know there was any money kept in the offices."
Although he knew it was a pay office and that there was a safe within. When asked to corroborate his movements, Jameson and Nicol both said,
"We did not see or hear the night watchman at all that night."
And following the attack, by the time the police had arrived, the night watchman turned up looking shocked, only for Jameson to ask,
"Where have you been?"
At which he replied,
"Over in the shelter. I saw nothing."
Next to Railway Arch 16 was an air raid shelter, but with no air raids reported that night, the shelter should have been empty. Only with Arthur Martin, the transport manager for Wimpy's, sleeping there as he'd missed his bus home. He didn't mention seeing or speaking with the night watchman at all that night. William Sturgeon was initially a suspect, but as the police would clarify,
"Without doubt, this old man was asleep during the time of the murder. But this is strongly denied by him for fear of losing his job. He is old, weak, and hardly strong enough to have crept in via the window, or to have dealt the blow which killed Mitchell, or caused serious wounds to Dyer and Jameson."
An inquest was opened on the 12th of November 1940 at Hammersmith Coroner's Court. It was assumed, but not proven,
that the thief had no necessity to force the office window to gain entry, and that the marks were expressly made to make the murder appear to be the work of an outside thief.
Jameson and Dyer were ruled out as accomplices, as both of their injuries were made while they were seated or asleep. Based on their timings, they had no opportunity to dispose of the weapon. And with George Chinnery, the air raid warden, being injured in a bomb attack just 1 week later, only his initial statement would prove viable, as like the two survivors, his memory proved both hazy and unreliable. When interviewed, the Irish labourers made statements which Jameson and Dyer corroborated. They admitted to a brief political argument, but denied any knowledge of the murder. Both had alibis for the time of the attack. Their lodgings were searched, but no weapon was found. And their finger, palm, and boot prints didn't match any of those found inside the office or on the desk below the window. On the 23rd of January 1941, at Hammersmith Coroner's Court, Margaret Hodge, Alfred Mitchell's sister, was asked,
"Do you know anyone who is likely to do him harm?"
To which she replied, "No." And with no one arrested for either crime, and nothing having been stolen, a jury of 12 men recorded a verdict of murder against person or persons unknown, and the case was closed. 83 years on, the murder of Alfred Mitchell remains unsolved. With no suspects charged, no evidence pointing towards a motive, and with it unclear who was the intended victim. Whether it was a failed robbery, a case of mistaken identity, a personal grudge, or an inside job, the truth would have gone to the graves with all of those involved. Just as the memory of what happened is now as hazy as those three dozing sleepers.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello, everyone.
How are we all today?
We all good and healthy? I'm still not 100%, but I'm getting there. I'm getting there. I'm better than last time, at least. I'm going to put my woolly hat on so I can keep my bloody head warm. Oh, full of snot. Although, thank God, I'm not full of all the mucus I've had. Almost all the mucus. You'll be delighted to hear. Almost all the mucus has gone now. Oh, lovely. I filled up a lot of bags full of mucus. Now I'm down to clear stuff now, which means the infection has gone, which is good. But I'm stuck with a really horrible hacking cough. Oh, please bugger off, cough. Anyway, it's the highlight of my life. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. I'm not going to go and make a cup of tea because I've still got one here. I'm working my way through it slowly.
Nothing really to grumble about during that record. There was a man with a lawnmower behind me, but he was far enough away. There was some dogs barking, that was in the distance. There was some Tweety birds, that was a while away. No boats have gone past to annoy me. I think that must be like a... There must be like an aura around the boat of people going, oh, he's been ill for a long time. He's probably in a bad mood. Stay away from him. Which is good. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. Thank you to... oh, you hear that? A very dry cough, that. Thank you to new patron supporter Alison. So thank you, Alison, for becoming a patron supporter. I hope you're enjoying all the goodies. And I finally got round to checking my supporter app thing. I keep forgetting because it's a real pig to have to find it. And Acast don't tell you when someone donates to the show. You have to go search. And I've asked them about it. They're like, oh, we have no intention of changing it. It's like, well, you should really. So thank you to Anonymous supporter, thank you very much for your kind words, and for Andrea as well. So lots of A's today. Alison, Anonymous, and Andrea. So thank you so much for your kind donations and becoming a patron supporter. Don't forget, even though this is a case about which is all unsolved, and there's nothing. Normally we can put a peg on something and say this is what we think it is. With this one, it's all very open. So that's why I wanted to attack this one and kind of show you everything that's there. Because there's a lot of possibles, but everything has elements to it where you just go, well, it's just kind of not really possible, is it? There's a lot going on there, so I really wanted to tackle this one. So, if you are a patron supporter, it doesn't matter what tier you're on, this is for all tiers, you can go to... I do my weekly thing, Bad Nanometers, and that's when I go into all the witness statements, and I read them in full. And that's what I'm going to do with this, is kind of pull out all the main witness statements and we're going to read them in full, and then you can kind of get an idea for yourself about what's true and what isn't true. Because as we know, just because someone gives a statement doesn't necessarily mean that it's 100% truthful. Quite often it's not, or it's a version of the truth, or it's perspective. So let's do some quiz questions, and then we'll dive into the extras. And then we'll dive into the extra stuff. So, question number one. How did George Chinnery know it was exactly 4 a.m? Question number two. What was the name of the company that all of the men worked for? Come on, you should all be able to get that one. Question number three. What was Alfred Mitchell's nickname? Question number four. How did Mitchell... brain's not working. Question number four. How did Jameson know that George Chinnery was an air raid warden? Question number five. Who conducted Mitchell's autopsy? Come on, you should all be able to get that one. Two there you should easily be able to get. Question number six. Who headed up the investigation? Question number seven. How much money was in the safe? You can either do it in old money or new money. Either is good. Question number eight. What town was Alfred Mitchell born in? Question number nine. Why did Mitchell sleep in the office? And question number ten. What job did Dyer and Jameson do? So don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet, so I may balls up some of these questions, but because this section is unedited, if I do balls it up, so what? Also, it's not really a big problem, is it? It's not really like a major thing. So let's dive into some stuff here. Just in case you're asking how my diet's going, it's going shit. Having had a slip disc since November and bronchitis the last couple of weeks and strep as well. Oh, I can't even go outside anymore because I've been isolating to make sure I don't give it to other people, or isolating as best as you can. So I haven't been able to do any exercise. And also I've been back on the Wenzel's Cake Shop, their Too Good To Go bags, where you can get a good bag for £4. And I found a good Wenzel's, a very good Wenzel's, where you get a bag that I swear it's like £20 worth of stuff. It's one of these ones that no one goes to. And they always deliver you like a nice big bag and you just go, oh, brilliant, great. So yeah, I've had a lot of cake. Oh, fuck it, who cares? I'll be back on my diet the second my lungs are repaired. If I go outside, I have a coughing fit. So I can't really do exercise at the moment. So I'm just getting fat, which Eva appreciates because it means I'm warmer. Therefore, when she puts her feet on me, it's kind of like a nice soft cushion. The fat goes around her feet and keeps her feet nice and warm, which she loves. And also she can, you know, my ass is slightly bigger, so she can perch her wine glass between my butt cheeks. That's what she loves. So anyway, I thought I'd dive into some stuff that I alluded to in there, but I haven't really dived into. And there were some kind of prior incidents with that they could remember of people who kind of were labourers there who'd had issues with either of the three men who were attacked. Now, Dyer couldn't remember any, but let's not forget Dyer. He was the one who was attacked and said he couldn't remember anything about the night, and quite a lot of his previous memory had kind of been messed up as well. So there may have been things there, he just can't remember them anymore. So that was the problem. So if you were to say this is self-inflicted wounds, I would say it's almost certainly not self-inflicted wounds, because these guys have seriously bashed themselves over the head to the point where they were in and out of consciousness, and it was, in some cases, it was touch and go with them. They had to be taken off the hospital, and they were not in a good way. So I think if you were going to do that, you would almost certainly give yourself a head wound, because the capillaries are close to the surface, and if you give yourself a small cut on your head, it can bleed a lot and it can look worse than it is, and that's what you want. But what you don't want is a skull fracture. And also, these men were lying down or seated at the time when these incidents happened, and their beds are a little bit too far away. The windows were closed. The only way out was through the doorway, and there was no blood marks towards the door. There were also no blood marks into Mitchell's room as well. So they were bleeding by the time and it looks like the attack may have happened shortly before the air raid warden turned up, because the light had just been put on, and Dyer was sitting on the edge of his bed holding his head, and Jameson was standing up. So it looks like whoever the attacker was, they just literally missed him. So so a couple of prior incidents. So there was one against Harry Jameson. Harry said, when I was working on a bomb crater at Cadby Hall. Cadby Hall is over in Hammersmith. It's immediately opposite where George Heath, the taxi driver that we dealt with just before Christmas, that's where he picked up his killers. Said, I had some trouble over wages with a labourer called Hegarty. He was discharged and started working at Lyons & Co. next to where we were working. The man had stolen a pick and a shovel. I did not speak to him and I did not ask for it back. Police spoke to this Hegarty. He seemed to have an alibi for the moment. There were two against Mitchell. One was a gentleman called Michael Houston from Londonderry, who worked for Wimpy's for 1 week last October 1940. He said, a short man in the office, so that is Mitchell, told me to go to a reception... Oh, fuck's sake. A short man in the office told me to go and to the ganger in North Holt. That's the gangmaster in North Holt. I went to North Holt and obtained a receipt showing the amount that I was due. This is for his wages. And I thought it was less than what I had earned. The short man told me they paid me 1.04 and quarter of a pence per hour. I thought it was going to be 1.05 and 12 pence per hour. There's a little of a discrepancy there, but as mentioned, you know, it's not Alfred who decides what people are paid. Like, you know, people come to him with his receipt that he gets from the gangmaster. Gangmaster gives it to the labourer. The labourer takes it to The pay office and the pay clerk, who is Mitchell, gives them the money based on what's written on the receipt. So it's not his fault at all of what's written on the sheet. And also it's not really the gangmaster's fault, because the gangmaster has to go based on what his bosses say is the going rate that day. This Michael Houston said, I said that I wasn't satisfied and said that said what I thought of the firm. I accepted what they paid me and walked out. As I did, I knocked over a fire extinguisher by accident. The police were called and I told them what the bother was. That seems to be the big thing that happened there, is he knocked over a fire extinguisher. I mean, he may have knocked over the fire extinguisher. He may have picked it up and used it in a threatening manner, because you wouldn't really call the police over that. But on the night of the murder, he was based in Chepstow. So Chepstow is on the border of Wales. So he was a decent way away. Don't forget, these are labourers. It's wartime. They're moving all around the country where the work is. So one other one was in August 1940. Mitchell had been in charge of a party of workers recruited from the Stepney Labour Exchange and conducted by him in Newport in the Isle of Wight, where they were employed by Wimpey on work, laying post office cables. A police report says trouble arose between the men and the company with regard the rates of pay. See, there it is again. And it was suggested that threats were made by some of the men against the dead man, i.e. Mitchell. It was suggested that one of the men may have killed Mitchell out of spite. Almost all of them were contacted, but without a good result. So they don't really have a suspect there. They said it could have been one of those men, but it's kind of odd, isn't it? It's like, if it's the same as the other one, and like you're meant to be paid per hour, like 1¼ shillings per hour, and instead of it's 1¼ shillings per hour, would you really travel from the Isle of Wight all the way into London in the middle of the night at 4 a.m. to try and find this guy to attack him in his bed and make it look like a robbery? That's the thing that's interesting with this, is that any of these men, if you had a grievance against them, you could attack them at any point. Do you know, they're out on the streets, they're out on building sites. Do you know, you could be working with your shovel next to them and you could whack them over the head in a discreet place, no one would know. So why would you go to the, if this is correct, that it is made to look like the person who attacked the place, who broke in, didn't know that the window was unhapsed, so a hasp lock. That's basically one of those ones where you have a circle and then a little kind of lock that just, it doesn't really lock, it just slots into place and it just holds the window in a position. That's all it really does. Why would you make it look like a robbery and not steal anything, even though the keys are kind of in his pocket? Or there was the deed box, they could have nicked the deed box, they could have nicked documentation, but they didn't. Nothing was really taken. Why would you make it look like a robbery but not steal something in order to kill someone, but then do an attempted murder on two other men? Or was it Jameson and Dyer who was the intended victims, but Mitchell got in the way? Or was it all three men who were the intended victims? Or was it mistaken identity? Or was it a failed robbery and Mitchell woke up and then the intended robber hit him over the head, and then the two guys, because don't forget Jameson said I heard a sound, so he woke up. So then the robber goes in and hits them both over the head, then realises that maybe that's the point. Maybe that's when the night watchman turns up. Night watchman, let's not forget, would have a little torch. He's coming into the yard going, oi, oi, put that light out. Maybe that's why the robbery never happened. Maybe they were disturbed by that point. We just don't know. This is what makes it really interesting, is there's, you could make out there's a big conspiracy going on here, but it might not be. It might be just something really that simple. The lack of security is kind of fascinating with this. Police said, although the door is fitted with a Yale-type lock, it is never locked. Neither is the door leading to the rear offices, which is fitted with the same type of lock, but is never locked. So there's the front office, the rear office, and then behind that was the night watchman's office as well. Oi, someone's going past too quick. Slow it down, bellend. He's going to be like, yeah, he's on his phone. Staring into space, wearing some shitty sunglasses, trying to look cool. Alright. Police said, therefore, a thief would have no necessity to force the window to gain entry to either of the offices, and may well be, as the window was not forced, that the marks of the forcing were made expressly to make the murder appear the work of an outside thief. I think that's too far. Why would you make it look like a robbery and not do the robbery if you were going to murder someone? It's too far. It's one of those things that you would possibly see on Columbo. But let's not forget, Columbo, real style murders, and then Columbo, and then proper murders are entirely different things. I love Columbo, but you've got to have a sense of reality in these kind of things. And I don't think that the police's idea on that was right. The argument with the Irishman, they hadn't met up before. They were both in different pubs. Pubs were close to each other, but not like literally a 30-second walk away from each other. So they knew each other pretty much. Jameson knew both Irishmen. That's why they stopped. They got each other, knew each other well. John Crowley, 23, labourer. They were staying at 170 Hammersmith Grove, which was a lodging house. Lots of kind of builders there. He came to England March 1940, single, employed by the same company. He'd been working there for about 7 weeks. His job to fill in bomb craters, and of course Harry Jameson was his boss. He was the one who said, "I don't know Dyer, but I know Fred Mitchell, who was the pay clerk at Wimpy's, and he paid me my money. When I have called at the passage at 16 the Arches, there is a little window where I get paid." So that's pretty much how far people... That's how far labourers go in. They don't walk into the office. They go to the window hatch. They hand over their things. They stay outside. That's as far as it goes. Joseph Malloy, 25, a labourer, single, so I'm going to blow my nose. Came here 3 years ago, i.e. to the UK. He's employed by the same company with his pal and works on the civil defence section, which is basically filling in holes and repairing things that were damaged during the bombings. Everyone pretty much says the same, that it started off nicely, everything was going well. Mitchell started being a bit of a bigot and a racist. Everyone was telling him to calm down. There wasn't really shouting, there wasn't fighting, there wasn't pushing, there wasn't shoving. No one pulled a knife, there's none of that shit. They'd been drinking, but they weren't pissed. It was only Mitchell who started getting bigoted about it. Everyone else was kind of backing away and just saying, "Come on, guys, it's time to go home." And that was pretty much it. It's not like Mitchell smacked one of the guys around the head, and you know, let's not forget, these are this kind of Irishmen in the 1940s. It's a very politically volatile time. They're used to receiving kind of abuse from bigoted twats who get their microscopic details of inverted commas fact from a tabloid and believe that they know everything about the world because, you know, they talk about it a bit in a pub full of racists. It's, you know, these Irishmen are kind of used to it. So really, would that lead them to the point where they would go, "Oh, we're going to wait 5 hours and then we're going to go around the corner to a place where we know there's a night watchman, we know there's an air raid warden, and we're going to pretend there's a break-in, and then we're going to break in and we're going to kill one guy, and then we're going to not quite kill two other guys because we like them but we don't want to kill them, and then we're going to steal nothing even though that would be an amazing alibi and even though the keys are kind of there, and then we're just going to flee, and then we're going to go back to our bed, and then at 7 o'clock in the morning we're going to go, "I'm wide awake now, it's time to go back to work," of which their employer at that time, Harry, would be injured and in hospital, therefore they probably wouldn't have work that day. There's so much in here that doesn't make sense. There's so much that you could run down a theory with it, but you would just hit a brick wall. And that's the problem with this, is that's exactly what it is. The only people who kind of saw them having drinks beforehand, so they had drinks from 10:50 till roughly 10:50 till meant to be 11:05, and that's roughly when John Nicol had already gone home by that point. he'd left. The three other men were in the office. They were having some drinks. I can't remember which one. Harry Jameson. He went to bed first, so at 11:05. The other two, Mitchell and Dyer, were chatting in the rear office. We know that they were chatting in the rear office and having drinks because the beer bottles were in there. And they'd poured some of it into cups, and their fingerprints were on the cups. But there were no other fingerprints there. Then they changed into their bedclothes and went to bed. It's nice and simple. No, there were other people in the yard, because it's a multi-purpose yard, but there's nobody else heard anything. Of course, we've got the night watchman, who's quite dubious. But even when you look at that, like you could say, well, he did it. But A, why would he do it? B, he's not really that useful. Do you know, he's not security. He's not there to keep people out. His job is to kind of stoke the fires, keep an eye on the office, to make records, but not really stop people. He's just kind of, you know, a man with a clipboard, really. Do you know, he's old, he's small, he's quite infirm. Everyone who kind of knew him said, I put that little reference in there about, they said, you know, sometimes the guys there, they really like me. Sometimes they give me a bottle of beer. He also said, I haven't had one in about a week. The problem is he's known for being quite a drinker. So it's likely, they said that quite often, either he would be in his little office at the back having a snooze, or he would go, as he did this day, he went back to the main office on Hammersmith Grove, and it's likely he had a snooze there. Therefore, all of his stories where he said, yeah, 7:30, I checked the office, and then I was back at 10 and 12 and 2, and I was almost back at 4, but obviously the police beat me to it. It's likely that this didn't happen, not because he's hiding the facts, because he's the murderer. It's, as the police said, it's likely that he just didn't want to lose his job. Do you know, he got form for snoozing a lot, rather than doing his job. Which, you know, people do. So who the suspect was, we really don't know. We don't know who this person is. Let's not forget that the only person who saw this person, A, would have been maybe Mitchell, but Mitchell's dead. Dyer can't remember anything. Harry Jameson said he roughly saw the shadow of the man. He said the build was similar to the Night Watchman, i.e. short. But he also said, I was on my knees at that point. The light was on, and this guy was in the shadow of the front office, so therefore he's in silhouette, so he can't see details. He can see a rough build, but he's on his knees, and he said, I can't work out the height. He also couldn't give age or any other details. So, and let's not forget, he's just been woken from a sleep, so he's dozy, and he's got a head injury, and he's probably got blood in his eyes as well. So, do you know, what he's able to tell us is not much. PC Taylor was the first officer to arrive, who arrived at 4:10 a.m. having been called exactly 4 a.m. He said, I arrived at 4:10 a.m. I saw two men bleeding, and in consequence of what they told me, I went to the front office, where I saw another man lying on a bed, and I noticed some blood on the blanket his head was resting on. I suspected foul play and immediately informed the police. There was no signs of any struggle at all. So even with that bit, the first police officer on the scene, even he was like, he didn't see it as a murder. He saw three assaults, which makes it quite interesting, really. So I think that's that for everything on there. Obviously, if you want to know more, there's we got bad nanometers. Bad nanometers, so I'll go through all the statements. I also do Walk With Me every week, so once I've finished editing, if I can do some walking, I go through a lot of the theories in there, and kind of things that appear in the episode that you won't know about, because it's sneaky things that I've snuck in. Also things that I've edited out as well, so yeah. Anyway, let's do the quiz questions. So, question number one. How did George Chinnery know that it was exactly 4 a.m? It was because the clock struck 4 as he entered the yard, which is interesting because during wartime, pretty much all of the clocks were on silent. I'm unsure whether this is a church clock. I couldn't find a nearby church clock, but it could have been half me is wondering whether it was a clock inside the office itself. So that wasn't quite clear, but a clock struck, according to him. Question number two, what was the name of the company where all the men worked? It was George Wimpey & Co. And if you live in the UK, Wimpey's is one of the big building firms still there today. Question number three, what was Alfred Mitchell's nickname? It was Fred. Although, I didn't put this in the episode, John Nicol referred to him as Twinkle. We don't know why. Question number four, maybe it was a joke because he was such a grumpy bastard. Question number four, how did Jameson know that George Chinnery was an air raid warden? Because he had a big W on his helmet. Question number five, who conducted Mitchell's autopsy? It's a nice easy one for everyone. It was Sir Bernard Spilsbury, of course it was. Question number six, who headed up the investigation? It's probably a hard one because I only mentioned it once. Divisional Detective Inspector Frederick Young. Question number seven, how much money was in the safe? You can do it in new money or old money. It was £150, 2 shillings and 8 pence, which is roughly £8,000 today. Question number eight, what town was Alfred Mitchell born in? That was Peterhead. Question number nine, why did Mitchell sleep in the office? Because his commute from his sister's in St Albans was too far. And question number 10, what job did Dyer and Jameson do? They were gangers, i.e. gangmasters, meaning they ran a team of labourers. So there you go, folks. That was that. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back next week. I think it's a two-parter next week, so looking forward to that one. So I hope you enjoyed that, folks. Have yourself a good one. Stay safe. Be good. Don't get sick. Quarantine if you have to. Eat lots of cake. Drink tea, etc., etc. Have a good one, folks. Stay safe. Best wishes. Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.